You're listening to Upfront. I'm Antonia Yuhas. Joining us in studio is Mark Shapiro. He has won numerous journalism prizes, it says so right here on the back of his book, for his investigative reporting. His latest book is Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. Thanks for being with us, Mark.
Great to be here, Antonia.
So let's just dive right into it. Why write a book about seeds?
Excellent question. Jesus, that is a superb question. And, you know, I've been presented with this question in various forms. And, of course, I've had to think about that question because I spent several years on this, including reporting on it and writing it and stuff. And I think one of the most fundamental things, which is have become so evident to me, but I don't think is maybe evident to many people, is if you're thinking about food, which, let's face it, a lot of people in this area particularly think about food, about the health of their food, about where it comes from, about how it's grown. You start thinking about food, and the number one question when it comes to the food we eat is seeds. It starts with the seed. The decision over what the seed is that's planted in the ground is going to determine how that plant is grown, who's going to grow it, what the conditions are in which it's going to be, what the relationship is of the person who puts the seed in the ground to the person who owns the food that comes out of the ground. These are all questions that are determined by the seed. Mm. And so I've been reporting on environmental questions for a long time. And I thought this matter at a time of two things happening simultaneously. One, climate change is profoundly altering the conditions for growing food. And I demonstrate ways in which that's happening in the book. And two, you have this incredible consolidation that's been happening in the seed industry. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was very important right now to actually address head on this question of actually who controls the seeds that we need going forward to ensure, number one, a healthy food supply, and number one, a reliable food supply. And so that, in the big picture, is why I ended up writing a book about seeds.
In fact, you write that more than half of all commercially traded seeds have fallen under the control of just three multinational agrochemical companies.
Concentration of control is one of the reasons that I was spurred to write this book, because it's now our question, our decision as citizens, as to who we want controlling essentially our food supply. Now we have three companies. This is what I describe. I write about this in the book, and I write about how this happened. Three companies, large multinational companies, that control more than half of commercially traded seeds. Who are those companies? Okay. Every single one of them is a chemical company. So you start with Dow, DuPont. Many Americans, many listeners may recognize the names of Dow and DuPont through various chemical, toxic chemical scandals over multiple decades. And those two companies merged and are now called Dow DuPont, and they own a huge array of seed companies. The second multinational seed company is Monsanto. Monsanto is now absorbed by Bayer. Okay, Monsanto, people are pretty familiar with Monsanto in this country and around the world, and was absorbed by Bayer, the huge pharmaceutical and chemical company from Germany, earlier this summer. They're now one company, so it's now called Bayer Monsanto.
Why does a pharmaceutical chemical company want to own Monsanto?
They are breeding seeds on a mass scale that are dependent on the chemicals that they produce. They're breeding entire generations of crack baby seeds.
Yeesh.
That are born addicted to chemicals, pesticides, herbicides, et cetera. So I think, and just to finish the circle, yeah. the third major transnational seed company is Syngenta, which is actually a Swiss company that was bought about a year ago by the largest chemical company in China, which is called ChemChina. So these three companies, Syngenta, ChemChina, Bayer Monsanto, Dow DuPont, control more than half of all commercial seed transactions in the world. So the question that I pose in the book and that I dive into is really, number one, what are the implications of this concentration of control? And also I journey into the incredible kind of expanding world of people who are resisting the control of these companies over the seeds that are grown.
And you describe these as the seed warriors, and perhaps the three companies I might term the seed demons in this depiction that you've created, because I think this is critically important idea, which is creating seeds that are from their birth dependent on the pesticides and the chemicals that the same companies create. And in so doing, not only creating a potentially closed loop, right? All seeds generated are seeds that are dependent on their chemicals, but also creating seeds that could inherently be dangerous, right? I mean, this is what you lay out, the dangers associated with this type of the use of the chemicals, but also the chemical dependency. What should a healthy seed look like, or a seed that is healthy to us as humans and healthy to our planet?
Well, first of all, what are the collateral effects of the mass application of pesticides and herbicides? And this has been documented, including by me, but by many, many other people, about the huge public health consequences of the application of chemical pesticides. And we've just had here in California the incredible lawsuit against Monsanto, which led to a massive guilty verdict for poisoning a single farm worker representing all farm workers. But this is happening all across the spectrum. Number one, of the public health consequences of this kind of reliance. And there is another factor that I think is very important, and that is that these seeds are I interviewed a Monsanto official in the book, which is in the book, and she told me something which I think was very revealing. It was actually very interesting to hear, was essentially because I was asking her how the company's responding to climate change. And by the way, all these companies are aware of climate change. None of them are climate deniers because they can see what's happening on the ground. And she said, well, we try to, in all of our genetic engineering and all of our breeding and all the other stuff that Monsanto is doing, we try to separate the seed from the environment it's growing in by creating a new environment with the help of chemical substances that to protect against pests or diseases or whatever it might be. And so what that means is, number one, we have the huge collateral effects in the public health. Two, you have seeds that do not evolve in response to particular conditions. Mm. And so they're taken out also of the forces of evolution that happen in every field and every across the world since the beginning of agriculture. And what's interesting, and what I write about, and why this is a particularly unique time for this question to be raised, and which I'm hoping to do, is that the dramatic changes that are happening in growing conditions, and I document what those are. Some of you, I'm sure, and other people can surmise what they might be, but there are enormous shifts in the amount of water that's falling, in the temperature alterations, in the frequency of extreme events. And this has led many of the top scientific institutions to say we are facing a serious crisis in the current form of agriculture because those seeds are not able to adapt to these kind of circumstances. They're bred for a very specific, tightly wound set of conditions. And what the science, in addition to the long experience of farmers, but now we're actually starting to see an accumulation of science, is showing that locally bred seeds that are that have evolved in a particular region over many, many, many seasons, have a much greater capacity to respond to those environmental stresses and to adapt to those environmental stresses. And, you know, it's funny because I think farmers, or many farmers, have known this implicitly. I mean, and you talk to people even beginning 20 years ago, many people in this area would kind of assume that implicitly. Look, there's a much healthier way to grow food. And now what's happened is you've had about a 20 to 25 year span for longitudinal studies, which are actually affirming this principle in some of the top scientific journals. And so, and I cite those in the book, and I tell many of the stories of people who are actually pursuing this kind of growing of food and how it compares to the industrial forms. And so it's funny. I'm not a farmer. I don't want to pretend to be a farmer, and I'm not a farmer, anybody. So, but I do actually see a fundamental battle unfolding now over the form that our food growing food is taking, as climate change changes the dimension and accentuates and accelerates the stresses that we're experiencing, and people begin to take their seeds into their own hands. And between there, you have a very interesting struggle.
Let's talk about this issue of the narrowing of the genetic diversity of the seeds and how that's come about and what and its significance.
Conditions are so volatile that that you can no longer breed seeds to keep up with these changes. And I show over and over and over again, I have a great story. And I tell this a lot through incredible stories that I've come upon in the course of doing this book, because I wanted to tell through the people who are involved and some of these seed rebels, I call them seed rebels. They are, there's an incredible story about a seed bank in Abu Ghraib that was once a prison. Many of your listeners are going to remember that horrible name. Well, in addition to being the home to that prison, it was also the home to a seed bank in the middle of the Fertile Crescent. Remember Iraq before it was a bludgeoned country? It still is in the middle of the Fertile Crescent, and which was the seat of domesticated agriculture. So shortly after the American invasion, a bunch of Iraqi scientists desperately tried to save the seeds that were in that seed bank and race them across the border to Syria into Aleppo, and where there's also a very major seed bank. And they grew those seeds for about 10 years, as well as all the other Syrian seeds that were already there, seeds from the whole Middle East region or the whole Fertile Crescent region, which are the oldest seeds of domesticated agriculture in a hot and dry climate. So then about 2016, and I've talked to people who worked at this research center, it was an amazing place. International scientists would go in and out of there studying, like, what are these seeds they're able to survive in heat and dry conditions. And then, of course, the Civil War came to Aleppo, which had been a redoubt of the resistance. Bashar Assad started bombing Aleppo and the surrounding area. And another team of scientists put together their seeds, threw them in the back of a van, raced the van across the border into Lebanon, and there they are now, those Syrian seeds, in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, being replanted in Lebanon, which is also part of the Fertile Crescent, as well as in Morocco, where there's another seed bank. So this story, number one, is incredible how people understand the value of these seeds. They understand how they're important. And then just to wrap up this story, we end up with, let's now take us back, changing gears here for a minute. Let's go to the American Midwest. Mm. Let's visit the middle of the United States. Let's go to Kansas. Now, what is happening in Kansas? Well, Kansas has been experiencing these rocketing temperatures, unprecedented levels of drought. And one of the effects has been incursions of a new pest that have been attacking the wheat in the wheat belt of America. And they're called the Hessian fruit fly, which is actually kind of where the larvae and the fly eat the wheat leaves and have been causing devastation. So just to wrap this fantastic circle up, the only seeds in the world that have resistance to this fly are the seeds from Syria. And those seeds are now being integrated into the American wheat crop to give them resistance to this to the surging insect population. And I tell this story just because in a sense, seeds are the most cosmopolitan entities we have in the natural world. They travel across borders. They bring their characteristics, and it's those characteristics imbued with those characteristics that are essential to be able to survive climate change. And these are not seeds that are bred in an insulated corporate laboratory. They're seeds that have evolved over thousands of years in hot and dry conditions. And there are many other stories like this that I tell.
And so the genetically altered and chemically altered seeds of the companies essentially are not able to adapt at the same speed that nature is able to adapt in changing weather conditions.
Basically. And this assertion is now being backed up by numerous studies.
Okay.
Studies in the top journals, and they're referenced in here, including in the heart of the Midwest, including in places like Kansas, South Dakota, also in the Central Valley of California. So which gives force to this incredible movement that's actually happening in our own state, in our own region, but also all across this country and around the world. Are people beginning to reclaim their seeds? They're opening up seed libraries, seed banks. They're encouraging their use in different ways. This Organic Seed Association has had boom times, opening up new seed companies. So there's a counter trend, which I think is also important to remember.
And these are the seed warriors you're talking about, trying to protect and save, in great harrowing effect, the diversity of seeds that are left. So how did we get to this place? You start a story in 1985 with the patenting of seeds for the first time. How did we get to a place where companies have been able to dramatically control the seeds that are left and reduce dramatically the diversity of seeds that we have?
Starting in the mid-1980s, the set of companies tried to patent. But what's at the core of this matter is the ability of companies to patent life forms.
Mm-hmm.
And that began in the 1980s. The first case was actually General Electric, which is not a seed company, not yet, doesn't look like they will be. But they wanted to patent a bacteria, living bacteria that could eat oil. They wanted to do something for, you know, whatever, to actually a bacteria that could eat oil after an oil spill, which may be a useful thing.
Turns out nature already has those, but that's okay if
apparently.
You want to make it in a test tube, too.
Fair enough. But the first response of the U.S. Patent Office was say, no, you can't patent a bacteria. That's a living organism.
Okay.
And they challenged that all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, yes, you can patent this organism because you created it in the laboratory at General Electric in that case. That was the first case called Chakrabarty case. Anybody can look it up. And but what's interesting about that is that then set into motion a number of different cases, each of which followed each other over a span of about a decade, in which the ability to define a living organism was focused ever more specifically on different organisms, and that includes seeds. So by the late 80s, you actually had court cases which said that, yes, you can actually patent a seed if you have essentially created a new organism, even if it's going to adapt, right? That's what seeds is. We're not talking genetic engineering yet.
Okay.
We're talking about the hybridization of seeds. And so I document basically in the book how at each stage of this Supreme Court decisions, as they worked their way up the ladder, more and more focused on the patent rights of companies over living organisms, including their ability to enforce those patent rights, which later become very important in the prosecution of farmers for allegedly violating these patents. And at each stage, Monsanto, by the way, was the very first company in the mid-80s after that Chakrabarty decision to basically buy a seed company. It was a small little seed company in Arkansas. Mm. And then basically they started following essentially the lead of the Supreme Court, which elaborated these rights. And Monsanto was the first one to see this possibility of Monsanto was a small chemical company at the time. Mm. To see the possibility of merging the two, and then Dow, and then DuPont, and then started buying seed companies. And it progressed literally in step with the Supreme Court cases. And so you watch, and I describe in the book, I got a hold of the list of kind of patents that were given, because the early patents were even done, some of them were done by individuals who said, hey, I came up with this cool thing, and, you know. But you can see starting in the 90s how all the patents start shifting from individuals to big companies. And you can actually see that happen, and I describe that scene.
I am talking to Mark Shapiro, and the book is Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. To play the devil's advocate here, you quote in the book the Biotechnology Innovation Organization as saying, to feed everyone, we'll need to double the amount of food we currently produce, and that this is what the industry is able to do, produce lots and lots and lots and lots of food, and that that's what's needed. You know, that's the path forward to end hunger and to save the human race.
Your question about their assertion, which is essentially that we need to have these this kind of agriculture in order to feed the world. There are two things I take issue with that formulation. Number one, with the increasing sophistication of organic farming and the increasing recognition of how productive smaller and ecologically sound farms can be. And this is not just from me. This is actually numerous studies, and I write in here about how a study commissioned by the World Bank about 12 years ago concluded that, in fact, smallholder, organically-based agriculture can be equally, if not more, productive than the kind of mass industrial agriculture. That report was suppressed. I've now brought it to light in the book, which was a huge challenge to the industrial agriculture system, sponsored by the World Bank. Mm. So the first question is does it really produce yields that are higher than other more regenerative forms of agriculture that are not so destructive to the environment? And two is the notion that we have to pursue these environmentally destructive practices in order to, quote, feed the world is based on this fallacious assumption, which is that if we produce more food, it'll actually go to all these hungry people, these kind of hungry people out there. And it really, really kind of is at the core of this question. And I think we've been hearing what I call a fig leaf. It's a moral fig leaf to justify these practices that are, in fact, very destructive and, in fact, undermine independent farmers' ability to sustain themselves. And because the fact is that the quantity of food is not related to who gets to eat it. And you have numerous, numerous examples of huge farms cohabiting right next to people who are in dire economic circumstances, poverty. And that's, we could start in Africa, parts of Asia, and we don't have to go that far. We can go to our own Central Valley here in California.
What do you want people to walk away with after having read the book?
I think one is understand what the implications are of the three large companies that are moving into trying to dominate the breeding of seeds and what that means. And two, to grasp that there is an alternative world emerging very quickly and in exciting new ways to defy those ways of growing food, which is going to become an increasingly urgent question as time goes on.
And readers can join the Seed Warriors as described in the stories that are told in your book. An excellent place to leave it. Thank you. My guest, Mark Shapiro, is the author of the new book, hot off the press, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.